Hello and welcome to the Roy Harper podcast. This is episode number 34, coming out in late September 2011. My name's Paul Davison and I run the website www.stormcock.net. Now, the last podcast came out in July of this year, and an extraordinary amount of stuff has happened since then. But before we get cracking, I just want to give a quick introduction to people who might be new to the podcast. This is a fan-run show, basically. It's completely free. I'm a fan of Roy's and have been since the early 80s, and I thought it would be fun to put this thing together to play some of his music with his permission and get people in to have a chat with and just generally talk over the music, the lyrics, some of the issues around the music and generally chew the fat. And it's been going for a few years now, much to my surprise. And the reason I'm giving this introduction is that given that Roy has been on the radio and TV so much in the last few weeks, I thought there might be a few new listeners. So if you're a new listener, you're very welcome. Now, the format of the show is pretty simple. I play some of Roy's music. I try and keep a good mix in there. I normally have an interview. Quite often the interview's with another fan. Sometimes it's with a musician. I've been lucky enough to have Roy himself on the show quite a few episodes back as well. But sometimes I also play archive interviews. So in the last podcast I had an interview that Bob Harris did with Roy in the early 70s around the release of Live Mask. So we have that kind of stuff as well. And it's, as I say, completely free. I don't get paid anything for it. It's a labour of love. So if my waffling annoys you, terribly sorry, but at least you're not paying anything for it. And in this episode, we will have an interview with a guy called John Cholmondeley, who's a friend of mine that's another Roy Harper fan. And he's actually a runner of a small private party that we went to in July. And he actually had Nick Harper, who's Roy Harper's son, who's also a musician and a very good one, at that party. So we talk a bit about that, and I'll have some Nick Harper music for you to play on this podcast, as well as some of the Roy Harper music. Before we get cracking with the news, let's start off with the track, and I'm playing in the background Black Clouds, and this is the reissued version from Songs of Love and Loss.
You wake up in the morn. Will I see you forever, or will you be gone? Is our love just a toy that we borrow?
So if you're in the UK, you can't have failed to have noticed that Roy's been in the media a lot lately, and this is pretty much unprecedented from my point of view since I've been following him, and it's been quite extraordinary. He's been on the radio, Mike Harding's programme, Test Match Special, Talk Sport. He's been in the press, great article in Shindig magazine, article in The Word magazine. He's been on television on BBC Breakfast, which I never ever thought I'd be sat at the breakfast table watching Roy on the TV. He was on Later with Jules Holland twice this week, once on the live show on Tuesday night and once on the recorded one on Friday. BBC also have put some online stuff up. There's an exclusive performance of The Green Man, which wasn't broadcast, that's on the website, although I believe only people in the UK can access that. The whole world's gone mad. It's fantastic, because I have been following his stuff for so long, and it sounds really cliche, but it's a soundtrack to my life almost. And a lot of the things that Roy writes songs about have very strong resonance with me. It's just one of those things, you find an artist that says the things that you feel and says them in a better way than you could possibly do yourself. So I've been following Roy for so many years, and I'm absolutely delighted that in his 70th year on the planet, he seems to be getting some kind of recognition. And I really, really hope it leads to lots more people discovering his music. It's funny when you follow somebody that's a cult hero, because you kind of almost feel like they're your special secret. But he really deserves to be known by everyone that likes music or likes poetry or feels deeply about issues to do with life, society, all that kind of stuff. So this is just brilliant. And it all seems to have sprung from the release of the Songs of Love and Loss album. Now, that came out on digital download, and I talked about it in the last podcast, but the physical CD product is now available. And the company that's doing that, because it's been licensed to a third party, appears to have an amazing ability to get publicity and get TV spots and so on. So I don't know the people that are involved with that, but if you are listening, I can't thank you enough. You've done a brilliant, brilliant job. I'm just, you know, bowled over with what you've managed to do. Lots of people talking about Roy's gig in November, on November the 5th at the Royal Festival Hall. He has let slip that there may be some special guests coming along. I don't think he wanted to talk about it before the tickets had all been sold, but they of course went so quickly, again, just showing that there's a demand there that perhaps Roy didn't expect. But we're all getting very excited about the November gig. I'm bringing this podcast out late September, and I have another one that I'm going to do my very best to get out late October, just before the Royal Festival Hall gig, to keep some momentum going. And talking of the Royal Festival Hall gig, we are in the process of arranging an afternoon meetup at a pub. And in fact, I have two dear friends who went on a fact-finding mission last weekend, otherwise known as a pub crawl, to find a suitable venue. And we believe we have. And we're going to make an announcement on the Stormcock.net forums in the next few days with some details about that. Obviously, if several hundred people turn up, the pub will probably A, be delighted, but B, also run out of beer very quickly. But if you would care to go to www.stormcock.net/forums/VB, I think it is, there will be an announcement in the general forum there about what we're up to and what time you can meet up, etc. Because I really like talking to other Roy Harper fans, obviously, and we all have something in common, so can't be bad, can it? Now, on this podcast, I'm playing quite a lot of Roy's music, and I've decided to take all of the tracks from the new CD. Now, Roy has done some subtle remastering. He said that he's tried to manufacture the sonics of the tracks so that they kind of sound like they were all made for the same album. If you listen to the different albums, they all kind of have a different feel, different sort of sonic handprint, if you like. And I believe that he's tried to process the audio to make them all sort of kind of more sympathetic with each other, maybe have the levels a bit more aligned so that the album flows well. I do have a copy of it, of course, and I must say it's actually really worth getting, even if you are a long-term Harper fan and have got all or most of the tracks that are already on the CD, because it really flows together very nicely. Roy says that he was very surprised when he was compiling the lyrics book to find that around 40% of his songs were love songs, and that surprised him. And he thought that it would be rather nice to bring out a proper collection of those songs. And, you know, it's really good. It fits very well. And I think, actually, it may be one of the reasons why he's got so much publicity recently, because, well, let's say it's a bit less contentious. The love songs aren't quite so, anti-religion, let's say, or critical of certain parts of the government, that kind of thing, you know. So I think the love songs are a bit more palatable. That being said, Roy played White Man, or a shortened version, just two verses, on later on Friday night. And I never thought I'd see that on the BBC, I have to say. So he got his message across. Now, I'm going to do my best to put links to various media things in the show notes for this podcast on stillcock.net. Lots of people have put different things up on YouTube for people outside the UK that can't access the BBC iPlayer, which lets you look at these things officially, although that only lasts for a week anyway. So I'm going to put various YouTube and other links in the show notes. Please, if you're at all interested, go there sooner rather than later, because I have a feeling that the links will probably eventually disappear, because they're not really, strictly speaking, licensed, are they? So there you go. All right, I think we'll have another track now, and it will be I See You again from the Songs of Love and Loss album.
No good pretending, girl, you were for spending the rest of your days round my neck. Well, I'm not that strong, and my time isn't long, and my love isn't something to wreck. I wish we could share, but you'll never be there to me, having those kids with one man. Milk his frustration and get his submission, weep and wear black when he's gone. Well, I'll see you again by accident, or maybe I'll see you again. I'm feeling the reasons for why I went, like mountains between now and then. I wanted to help, but I couldn't stay, and I flew. What else could I do? I needed to stop you from falling in love that way. I didn't have it for all you. No way, no way. Left you stony with dreams cold and bony. I know how it feels, I've been there. I was your only fault, you're so lonely, faced with a permanent stare. All I was wanting was friends and good hunting. You want my soul behind bars. Well, love isn't jealous or bitchy and careless. She's here for us all, and she's always here. So I'll see you again. Accident, or maybe I'll but I couldn't stay. And I flew, what else could I do? I needed to stop you from falling, but anyway, I didn't have.
I'm on the line to John Cholmondeley, who some listeners will recognise from the Nigel Maslin-Jones interview that he kindly did for the podcast. Oh, I don't know, about a year ago, a year and a half? I don't know.
A couple of years ago, I think, yeah.
I think it was quite a while ago. But and John is a long-time member of the Stormcourt Mailinglist, and he's generally a good guy. And I've asked him to come onto the podcast this time around because in July we were lucky enough to go to the Summer of Love party down in sunny Kent, or rainy Kent perhaps, but anyway, and John is one of the organisers of that, and had got Nick Harper playing, which we'll get to in a little while, and I thought, why not get John on to talk about his festival experiences, etc. So, hi there, John, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm very good, thank you.
Before we get cracking, give us a sort of 20-second background of who you are and what you do, that kind of stuff.
Who I am, what I do. I work for a large computer corporation who are attempting to implement the NHS computer system at the moment.
Oh, I didn't know that.
which is a bit up in the air as of today. But
yeah.
I'm sort of IT. I originally trained as a chemist, but retrained in IT. And then.
Right.
But systems analysis and business analysis are more than technical things. So if you can't get your broadband working, I can't help you.
Did you sort of slide into IT just out of, you know, because that's
I worked in a chemistry lab for Anglia Water, and we ended up having a new computer system in there, and I got into that because it was something different and interesting to play with, and sort of, and then it actually went travelling, and about which time the internet appeared to the mass populations, and I thought, you know, this could be quite interesting. So I thought, I'm too old and too, you know, I didn't grow up with computers. I remember these nerdy kids with their little tape recorders and they'd completely rewritten Space Invaders.
I was
on
one of those nerdy kids, so be careful what you say.
Yeah, but you know I'm right. but, you know, they'd completely written Space Invaders on a C60.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I thought, no, that's just...
Happy days.
No, that's beyond me. So I kind of came to it in a roundabout way.
So, okay. That's roughly what you do. But, of course, there's an entirely different side to you, which is being one of the people that runs the Summer of Love. So what is the Summer of Love party? What's it all
about? I'd emphasise that it's a party really more than a festival, because it isn't, as you say, from the beam. We probably only have about 200 people, so it's really a very small gathering. It originated from a UK-based Grateful Dead fanzine, if they used the term in those days, called Spiral Light, which pre-internet, late 80s, early 90s, was about the only contact that the Deadheads had with the what was going on with the Dead over in the States, and they basically never came to the UK. And they used to have an annual get-together with a Grateful Dead band. I think they used the phrase tribute bands in those days, but usually called the Cosmic Charlies. And they had a do in Chesham for many years in a sort of healing centre with a big hall and some dormitories and things, and camping, which is perfect. And a combination of things. Basically, when Jerry Garcia died in 95, and I think we had one the year after, and then the people, the place got taken over, and they didn't want our business, so it sort of fizzled out, really.
Yeah, right.
And then most of these people sort of regrouped on the Euro Traders group, which is a Grateful Dead trading thing that was the big thing, the tapes and the live shows, which during the course of its lifetime has morphed from tapes to CDs to downloads. And now nobody actually really swaps bundles of tapes and discs and things. But 2007 was the 40th anniversary of the Summer of Love. And it was also my 40th summer. So I said to Chris, Chris Jones, who you know, that you know, we should try and resurrect the Chisholm parties. And there were a lot of new people on the group who didn't go back to Bickershaw in 72 or wherever these people, you know, traced their acquaintances. So, yeah, so, you know, we just get a field and a couple of barrels of beer and the generator and put the Charlies on. He said, I know just the place. And his friend has a very nice old, I think it's 14th century Jacobean house in the middle of nowhere in Kent, really,
yeah,
with basically
lovely.
A very large large meadow in the back garden, which is on a slope. So it's perfect and effectively no neighbours. So we asked Kent, could we hire his field out? And he was up for it. And so so we started it. And in the first year, we got away with this by the skin of our teeth. The stage nearly blew out. The stage was tiny. And we've progressively upgraded it every year.
I was going to say, this stage was looking pretty professional to me when we were there.
Yeah, on the first year, we had a sort of 6 by about 12 piles of staging with a gazebo lashed to it with masking to with duct tape, and but it was that very wet summer, and the PA guy wouldn't put his speakers on the floor in case it turned into a mud bath.
Oh, right.
So everything was crammed on, and it didn't work very well. But we were lucky that a word got out, and a chap called Michael Cole said that he would probably be able to arrange for Barry Melton, Barry the Fish Melton from Country Joe and the Fish,
yes,
an original of the Summer of Love, to come over and play with his mates who still play from various bands that he played with in the early 70s when he lived in London. They still play as a band called the Green Ray. So that was a bit of a coup. So we got Barry over, and for basically for expenses. And a couple of Kent's mates, Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook, he knew from way back. They came as guests, but didn't require too much encouragement. They spookily had got acoustic guitars in the backs of the cars, and they did a 25 minutes Squeeze Greatest Hits mini set, and stole the show, really, to be honest. But yeah, we got away with it. So. It's not gone wrong yet, so we're just rolling along.
I've got on my little crypt sheet here what its aims are. I guess the aims are to bring the like-minded people together and
yeah,
you know,
I mean,
have
really,
fun, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it was intended really as a social for the Grateful Dead community of and related people. I mean, you know, we've always sort of joking said if they're not the Grateful Dead, don't come, because they're not much else. But we've expanded the range of bands and things now. But it very much sticks to that ethos.
Mm.
And it, you know, and again, as a sort of complement to or reaction against the whole kind of virtual cyber thing of everybody, you know, just dealing with each other on emails. And not meeting up face to face.
As a fresh-faced newcomer to the festival, you know, my first experience was coming in through the gate and meeting Chris and him saying, "Oh, hello, I'm Chris," etc. And then we set our tent up and various people came over and said hello. And I thought, yeah, this is actually how it should be and probably used to be, you know.
Yes.
And excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Maz has certainly picked up on that, you know, and he says, yeah. And I guess, of course, I suppose it's retro, isn't it? It's an attempt to recreate the best bits of British festivals.
Mm.
Well, yeah, I mean, without the squalor and the tarpaulin in the mud. I mean, we're lucky. We've been, you know, when people are of an age where they're not really prepared to do that anymore. But you know, we've been blessed with glorious weather as well, so we've never had a washout.
Mm.
And it's, you know, it's just a nice chilling out weekend for people.
So, what's your particular role then? You're hearing about all over the place and introducing bands.
I was adopted being the MC because I can talk. I'm also notionally the treasurer. We've got it down fairly quickly now, fairly easily now. I mean, Kevin Geraghty-Shewan does all the technical stuff, which is another guy off the Eurotraders group. So, you know, we book the sound guy, we book the stage, we book the marquees, and we book the toilets and things and make sure that people are going to do the food. And then it's really between Chris and I booking the vans and Chris bullying people into paying.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get too in-depth into finances or anything, because obviously that's your business. But 200 people, it's going to be on a fairly tight budget, isn't it?
So. It is, and it's limited. And unfortunately, it's not quite a victim of its own success, but people like it. People say, oh, it shouldn't get any bigger, than anybody else in. Mm. But of course, you can only amortise your costs. Only, I mean, we based it on 150 people now.
Yeah,
we're fairly confident we can sell 150 tickets. Anything else is a bonus, but that's our break-even point. And of course, as we have more staging and bigger this, that, and the other, you know, the costs creep up every year. But people seem to be prepared to pay for it. I mean, you know, people like. I don't like to maintain that it's exclusive, but people like the fact that it is small, and in a sense, are prepared and realise that the way it's run and that nobody's taking any money out of the kitty. And it was all originally run. At the end of the day, the agreement was the money, you know, when it folds, if there's any money left, it'll go to charity. You know, and people realise that we put in a lot of work. I mean, Chris puts in a phenomenal amount of work for the love of it, really, and to make it happen. So everybody can turn up and go, this is the best weekend of the year.
The other thing I found interesting is, yes, there's a website, although it doesn't tell you where the actual festival is, where the party is, and... You know, you kind of spread the word amongst, you know, networks of like-minded people. And it's interesting approach, because you've always, you know, I know you've posted for the last sort of 3 years on Stormcock about it to see if anybody's interested. Because you know that Harper fans are going to have the right kind of mindset, I suppose.
I hope so, yeah. I mean, we don't advertise. We have bands, or they allow, or we encourage the bands to put it on their lists of gigs. I mean, it was on Nick's site, but just email this address. I think a lot of people can't be bothered, or they think it is a private party. We need to probably work on that a bit more, but it's a difficult balance.
Yeah, it is.
You know, we could probably sell 500 tickets if with a well-placed advert somewhere. I'm not quite sure where we'd advertise. you know, you can't have it too... We don't want it really any bigger, so we don't need to advertise. And it spreads by word of mouth. I mean, we've got some people who've been for 5 years now.
I think, you know, as long as the people that have come before or get the first dabs at getting a ticket or whatever, you know, and then you open it up. But, yeah, I think if you had too many more people, you'd have to move to a different location anyway. And I think at that point it's losing something.
Yes, and that's certainly my intention, to keep it that size. And the people... You know, the people who come, really, you know, the facilities are very basic, but for a couple of days, you know, it's all about the spirit of the thing, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so how did it go this year?
It went very well, considering it's the first year we've had serious rain. I think 2 years ago, I'm going to blame it on Dedicast, actually. The only other time it's rained was during about the last 2 hours of the Saturday night a couple of years ago. Elsewhere, we had basically glorious weather, which has always helped. But people, you know, people endured that. This is the first year we went for 3 days, which was mainly because by the time we'd paid Dedicast to come over from France, for those who don't know, Dedicast are all based in France. By the time they hired a minibus and come through the tunnel and got over here, you know, for another... We give them a little bit more, and they'll do a second set.
Right, yeah.
But we'd already booked Friday night, so we said, well, we'll let an acoustic Sunday afternoon chill out. And had the weather been better, I think more people would have stayed. But we emailed around. We have a mailing list group, a subscription group like Stormcock, and we asked people, and it was probably half and half in favour or against going to the third day. Particularly people who've travelled a long way.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know, the longer the better makes it more worthwhile, but then it's another day off work on a Monday, and if you can stay Sunday night. And Kent didn't want 3 nights of amplified music.
Right.
Blasting through the village. So as of now, I think we'll drop back to 2 days and just have a sort of more mellow, acoustic-y Friday and a all-day Saturday.
Yeah, we did scuttle off on the Sunday morning, but that's partly because we're fed up with it getting wet, and I had an irritable.
Yeah, I mean, it was intermittent. It was intermittent on the Sunday. And people have had enough, really, by then, to be honest.
Right. Well, of course, you know, one of the highlights of this year was that Nick Harper was playing. How did you get Nick to play? You just approached him and he said yes, or was it...
Yeah, well, I'd asked him a couple of years ago. I'd emailed him, I think, and I spoke to him after a gig at the Robin, and he was like, yeah, contact whoever it was. And we never really heard back from him. I don't know what it didn't happen last year, but I said, no, I'm determined I'm going to get Nick Harper this year, you know. And Chris contacted his agent, and he was up for it. So it's as simple as that, really. He just exchanged a few emails, and he was, you know, we try and be at pains to explain to people what it is and what it isn't.
Mm.
I was correct in my assumption that Nick would enjoy that and appreciate it. You know, some people come thinking, oh, there's going to be hundreds of people and stalls and concerts and blah, blah, and, you know, no, it's not that at all. You know, but equally some people wouldn't want to, you say you're lucky to get 200 people. So it's a balance, really, between finding who we can afford and who we'd like and who people have heard of.
Well, he counted as a famous person as far as my son's concerned, because I've been, weaning him on bits of my music collection. And, in fact, the week before the party, William said to me, do you know the chords to the verse Time Forgot? And I said, I don't know. And I think it's probably a bit tricky because he uses strange tunings. But you can ask him next week. And he looked at me and I could tell he didn't really believe me. And then, you know, we were sat in our fold-up chairs watching whoever it was when in the afternoon. And Nick drove down in his car and opened the window and said, hello. William's face was a picture, so I think my social capital with my son has increased 100-fold. He did get some guitar advice from him as well, which was very sweet.
Yes. No, I mean, it's nice having a name. I mean, obviously, everybody's heard of his dad. You know, Martin Stevenson, a few people have heard of. And it's finding a balance, really, bringing new people in and having a reasonably interesting headliner that pulls people in. But we've found over the years that it doesn't really, to a lot of the people, it doesn't really matter who's on. We maybe get one or two. I think we had obviously two or three people come because I advertised it on Stormcock. Probably came because Nick was on. You know, a few people we had one year came specifically because Nick Turner's band were on.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, and they come again. And then, you know, and if one or two people came because Teeth of the Wicked were on, or, you know, I
loved them. I thought they were excellent.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this on their website. How come I've never heard of this festival before? Because you're not supposed to. but bring your mates next year, you know, if you've enjoyed it. So it's nice to have people come and sort of explain, you know, come on, mate, I'm really into this. You know, rather than hordes of screaming kids and people getting out of control. And we don't have to have any security or anything. So.
Well, you know, for many years we've been going to Crop Ready, which is the Fairport Convention one, but even that's got too big for me now. I'm sounding like an old fart here, but
how big's that now?
Well, I don't know. It's too bloody many. I mean, it's one big field, you know, a nice sloping field, excellent situation. But you know, one year I just felt like there was people crushing me all around. It was just getting too much, and I thought actually I think they're going a bit over the top here. And then the next year they announced they were having Status Quo play, and I thought I don't really need to hear that. So I thought
not at a folk festival, no,
not really. So I haven't been back since.
Yeah, I mean they always seem to have. We took the kids to a little thing called Bearded Theory last summer, and I think it was about 3,000 people.
Mm.
And there was enough going on, and there were four or five stages all running concurrently. So there were probably only 300 or 400 people in front of the main stage. Certainly, you know, on a Saturday night when New Model Army were playing, there were still only 300 or 400 people there. Mm. You could put it in one, you know, you could just squeeze your way down to the front, and it was perfect.
Yeah. Okay, so is there any, have you got any tales to tell us about stuff that's happened anecdotally at Summer of Love, or have we covered that already?
I think we've covered it. And I say our best little story was probably the surprise appearance by Difford and Tilbrook. And the seemingly endless appearances by Barry Melton, who came there the first year, and we didn't think he'd really enjoyed it, but he apparently had a whale of a time. And he came back. He played with Dedicass a couple of years ago because he'd been playing with them in France. Somehow he'd some connection with their sax player.
All right.
That when he found that, I think when they when he found out that Dedi Kaas were playing, he's like, "I'll be there, I'll be there." And he put in a good word with us for with David and Linda LaFlamme, who were, it's not the original Linda LaFlamme, but David LaFlamme from It's a Beautiful Day, who were another San Francisco band. He was a classically trained violinist, but he came over and Barry in a backup band, virtually on Barry's recommendation. And they obviously Michael Cole booked some of the gigs for them, but that was a bit of a coup.
Well, that's so, lovely to hear, because it means, you know, people appreciate what you're doing and spread the word, and therefore,
I mean, some bloke in the States goes, it's worth going over and playing in this field in Kent because you'll have a really good time. You know, that's PR we can't buy.
Have you started planning next year yet?
Yes, we've already been contacted by the agent for a German German dead tribute band called Cosmic Finger,
right?
To get who we had been talking to. It's borderline really on what we can afford to pay people to bring four or five guys from Europe.
Yeah,
they're not going to make much money out of it at all. But the argument is, if you don't play for 100-odd hardcore deadheads, then who are you going to play to? But they've just got some gigs supporting Mo when they come over from the States in Holland and Europe in the spring. So potentially that'd be a good PR for us. I know if they can pick up some interest from those kind of fans. Hopefully, so that remains to be seen. But they obviously, you know. There's a Santana tribute band we had a couple of years ago who pulled out on us because a couple of their people had got the wrong weekend and were decided to go on holiday.
Oh, right.
So they owe us a gig. There's quite a lot of people, you know, there's a long list of people we'd have back again. And we're trying to get some variety. We're after a dub reggae band and whatever else we can conjure up. We had a little acoustic stage up by the bar this year, which I'm sure you've saw, which was a roaring success. But that means that we can shift a lot of the kind of singer-songwriter acoustic people up there and have a wider variety of bands, styles on the main stage, really, and possibly even have fewer acts and play a bit more and get a mix of people. But it's nice because it's a fairly receptive audience. We've got an idea now what will and won't go down well. You can't please everybody, but it's, you know, some people come and they just say, "I just like the variety of it. I just sit here. I don't know what these people are going to be like, but they're always good and they're always entertaining."
Yeah. No, that's what festivals are all about to me. You don't go there to see U2 or somebody like that. Yeah. You go there to experience new stuff and, you know.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether you've spoken to Nick about this, but this is one of the interesting things, really, because I would imagine in reality, Nick plays to 75% of parties and fans time after time.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, and it's great because you can heckle him and blah, blah, blah. But he's not picking up any new fans, whereas he probably is probably the other way around there. I would imagine that, you know, 25% at most knew anything about him.
Yeah.
As I sort of said at the end, you know, and a lot of people go, "That Harper bloke, he was good," you know. And I said, "Well, that's the idea, man. Now buys records." Yeah. and it helps these people. I'm saying with Madeline Jones, really. I mean, a few people have bought some of his CDs, and he doesn't tour very often.
He doesn't.
Nick's around often enough to capitalise on that, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Nigel did a set at Glastonbury this year, but I think that's been it so far. I haven't seen him for yonks, absolutely ages. Yeah. Okay, talking of musicians in general, I'm going to get onto my favourite bugbear at the moment, which is musicians and the music industry and everything. And the reason I want to talk to you about this particular, John, is that... I won't go into too much detail because it was a private conversation, but I talked to Nick about how stuff was going with him, etc. And he basically said things were really, really tough at the moment. Mm. Gig attendance has gone down a lot. He's moving into some smaller venues. For example, I saw him in Cambridge earlier in the year, and he was playing in a pub with a fairly decent stage and everything. But it was a bit of a... It was a bit of a change from playing in the smaller of the two junction rooms at Cambridge, which is a big theatre with really nice seating and everything.
Yeah. Which
one was it? Oh, I can't remember offhand. Yeah.
Boat race.
Oh, it might have been, actually. Anyway.
I spent many evenings in Cambridge.
And, you know, he's downsizing his gigs, and that's tricky for him, because I know he's told me before that he makes most of his money from live performance and very little from CDs. I mean, you get in the similar vibe. I mean, you must talk to the artists that you book. You must have people.
I mean, a lot of these people, at the end of the day, it's a gig. And certainly, a band like Dedicas, which is a specialist market, they do it for the love of it.
Mm.
But you want to get out and play in front of a live audience and know it's live and have to, you're flying by the seat of your pants. So, a lot of these bands will take any gig they can get, provided it's basically cost effective.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you've got people like Nick and Martin Stevenson, who are professional musicians, and you think, well, we're paying the going rate. It's a day's job for them. It's what they do. And, if we don't pay them, then they don't get to do what they do. Mm. I'm sure it's difficult. And, the numbers are dropping. It's... I talk about this for hours. It's a combination of factors, really, isn't it? But I just don't think it's the big thing that it was, perhaps even in our age and, earlier times than that, really. I just don't think music is the... Well, the whole... I suppose it's the music and the fashion and the counterculture and the tribal thing and, the hippie thing and then the underground and then punk and then rave... It's gone now. It's all been done. It's all been watered down. And there isn't the base market. So a lot of these gigs were just people went because they were the bands of the time and they were all, and I suspect a lot of times people went because it was a gig to be seen at.
Yeah.
Whereas now, for a lot of these, for people who aren't in the moment, then you don't have that market. And if you're core market is an older age group who've got other things to spend their money on and less time to go out and stuff. It's a diminishing audience to start with.
That's the thing. They'll have more money, but they'll also have more things to spend it on.
Bills and, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not like then you just went into town and just rocked up at these gigs night after night and like you do when you're a kid in the studio.
Yeah,
I just don't perceive that for the young ones. I mean, some of the kids you see, they're into the metal and the goth and things, and you think, well, how much of it's a fashion thing and how much of it's stuff, but, they don't have the income. I mean, the student markets. I mean, if you look at these classic bands from the late 60s, early 70s, if you find any of these old magazines, and you look at the tour, and virtually every venue is a university or a college.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
virtually. And now that scene is gone.
Mm.
I don't know why. Whether the unions haven't got the money to put the bands on, or I don't know. I mean, I remember they were struggling when I was at college in the mid
80s. Yeah, same here. I mean, we had the ends
put bands on, but you look back at some of these bands in the early 70s, it was all colleges.
Mm.
And the kind of Odeon size venues have all gone. The 20-day UK tour to support the new album has gone. It's four or five gigs and a few high-profile things. Which is ironic, really, because if you think if these bands do claim that that's where you make your money, but I don't think you make as much as you do playing the bigger gigs.
Well, I think people still have an inbuilt need to experience live music, because you can tell that it's, well, it's never going to stop having that effect on people, energizing people. The impact of live music is so profound, but maybe it's just fallen out of favor in some ways, and there's a whole bunch of people who never experience it now.
I think there's an element, yes. And I think the mainstream, I've only listened to the charts for donkey's years, listen to but apart from the sort of indie bands, which is all very wishy-washy, it's mainly dancey, hip-hop, what have you, and, your Beyoncé's and Lady Gaga's and stuff, and it's all... this is me observing from a great distance, but it's all about the show and the production. It's not about four kids rocking the mic in a little... in the back room of a pub. That whole, it's a different culture. It's just not what it was when we were that age and young. And I don't think it's as exciting. I think it's all been done before now. I was reading a very interview with Andy Kershaw in The Word, who's plugging his autobiography. But he was basically saying that he got bored with rock music. He said, it's been going 60 years now. It must run out.
Doesn't every generation say that, though?
I think they do, but I really don't think it has the same impact now. And I don't think it has the cultural impact that it had in the... Well, I think rock and roll was a huge... I
mean, that's true. Know, that was enormous.
I was talking to my daughter, saying the impression, doesn't matter how good a singer he was and how good looking he was, the impression, the impact that Elvis Presley made, particularly in the States, largely because he was white. Mm-hmm. He was sensational. He was outrageous, and the kids loved that. Anything that's kids will love that. And it was rebellion. It was acting rebellion. And then of course the whole 60s hippie counterculture, Vietnam War, thing was a massive generational gulf.
That's true.
Now, when your dad says, "Do you want tickets for Coldplay?" I'm thinking, "No, die."
Well, you've got corporate rock now, and we certainly didn't have that.
Well,
then.
but that generation thing is gone. My parents had no, they were a little bit too old for the Beatles. My dad would still talk about, playing Rock Island Line in a skiffle band, I think, when he was 18. But it stopped there, really. They were just a bit too old.
Yeah.
Or too early. Let's be polite, too early for the full kind of impact of that, '60s thing. But it was that whole counterculture. It was deliberately opposite to what was going on in the mainstream, which was what your parents did, and the class system, and the whole system. And then of course that became mainstream, and it, I guess the energy and the thing faded. And then punk came along, and it all started again.
Yeah, it did, didn't it?
And then I suppose you could argue that then the next thing that was really like that was rave, acid house, in terms of just being completely diametrically opposed to your Smiths indie guitar band type stuff. And I can't see it's ever happened since, but I don't know. And then punk gets recycled and how can you rebel? How can you rebel when your dad can tell stories about going to the Clash? I mean,
maybe it will just die away for a while. This is a terrible thing to admit, but when you were talking, I was thinking of, I don't know whether you know Rush's album 2112.
I know it very well. Going
into lovely prog rock territory here. The guy finds a guitar which magically, seems to be plugged into an amplifier and starts strumming it, and it all becomes this great symbol of rebellion against the evil overlords. Maybe it just needs time to lie dormant for a while, and then when we all are, corporate drones, there'll be a resurgence.
Yeah, well, again, another conversation we were having over the summer of the weekend is where is that? Somebody was talking about the student protests against. I mean, you might argue it's all naked self-interest, but at least they're out there protesting. At least they're kicking up a stir.
That's right.
What Charlie Gilmore's got to complain about when his dad's got X billion.
We'll
let that one slide. But at least there is a rebellion there, because eventually you reach a point where you can't do it. It's just because if there isn't a groundswell of popular opinion against whatever, the corporatisation and the loss of civil liberties and blah blah blah. Let's not preach about it. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Eventually, there comes a point where you won't be able to do anything about it. And I don't know. But whether there'll be another hippie generation, you see a lot of you open Mojo and Uncut, and all these bands have all got beards and acoustic guitars.
Sure.
And then, the most, obviously, you've got Mumfords and all these kind of people, but you're thinking, we come from a generation where, wearing a waistcoat and having an acoustic guitar was an anti-fashion statement.
Yeah.
And it was deliberately, no, I don't want to put the iPad 7 and a bling this and that. It was a deliberate statement.
Well, I think that a lot of it stems from this sort of gradual culture of fear that's crept up on people in the sort of 20 or 30 years. Yeah. But everybody's frightened basically, of losing their job or being shown as being something unusual. And you know, all it will take is some event that will cause some critical mass. And I thought the student protest was part of that happening, actually, but it's all gone quiet for the time being. People will eventually realise that they can be different and they can speak up for themselves and the world won't end, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully, yeah. I mean, it's certainly, you know, I'd push my kids in that direction. Mm. But it depresses me, really, in effect, that that's all gone. But going back to what we were saying earlier, to bring it forward, you know, I think it's difficult to underestimate how much the music and the records that people bought were tied in with that sense of a counterculture, of a tribal group, and everybody in their great coats, or everybody in their mohawks, or, you know, and we were different, we were out there, we've got our own different set of values and ideas and stuff, and you just don't see that now. Whether it will come back, I don't know. I mean, it had pros and cons, I'm sure, but it was a definite generational thing, wasn't it?
Changing tack briefly, we're nearly wrapping up here, but one thing that's I've taken away from the party, which has really surprised me, was that there's a lot of really good music playing on the PA between the artists, and particularly when we arrived on the Friday and were setting up the tent, etc. There's some really good live Grateful Dead music playing. And it set me thinking about the Grateful Dead because many years ago I had a mate called Paul Durish, who used to be at Edinburgh University. He won't be listening to this, but it's possible that somebody else that's listening will know him because he was, you know, very active on the email front. I don't know where he ended up, actually. I think he might have gone to Xerox in the end. And he was a Grateful Dead fan, and he knew about my slight Harper obsession. So he actually said, I'll tell you what, he said, I've started collecting some tapes. So he gave me 3 Grateful Dead shows on cassette, which I've still got somewhere, but I haven't dug out yet. Yeah. And he said, oh, you know, there's this whole trading thing going on and these shows, etc. Have a listen to those. And I listened to them and I thought, well, this is all a bit odd, really, because it's a complete mixture of styles. I'm not sure what I think about it, really. And then the next year or the year after was when they played at Wembley. Was it Wembley? Yeah, it was Wembley.
Yeah, Wembley 1990.
And I went to one of those gigs and it was a real event. The funniest thing that happened was... I don't know whether I've said this on the podcast before. I'd had too much of that horrible, terribly expensive fizzy beer and needed to go to the toilet. So I sort of stood up and got to the end of the row and there was this security guard. And I said, do you know where the loos are? And he was sort of, you know, one of the Americans that had flown in, basically, to look after security. And he looked at me completely blankly and said, well, I don't know. No, I can't help you with that. And it wasn't until later that somebody said he probably didn't know what lewds meant and thought you were asking for lewds, as in quaaludes. And I said, oh, I don't know. It's just completely weird. And it was at that point I thought, yeah, there's something going on.
There's something going on here.
But I've kind of not really listened to them for years. But I've since coming back from the party, I've actually started listening to... the album is in chronological order and some of Dick's picks as well and stuff like that. And I'm really enjoying it. But it's taken me this long to realise that the band isn't one particular style. I think when I first started listening to them, I was expecting some, you know, 2-hour-long psychedelic freak out, and that's not the case, you know.
It depends which album you start.
Well,
I'd known about them, and they were, because you can't read a sentence that reads Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Crosby, Stills and Nash, and the Grateful Dead. And you see the album covers and you think, where'd you start? Mm-hmm. And I found a book on them in the library, and it got all their albums rated in the back. Oh. And it said Working Man's Dead and American Beauty, which for those that anybody not familiar with it, they are basically acoustic harmony records. And it said, you know, they allegedly were taught harmonies by Crosby, Stills, Nash. I thought, well, that's an entry point. I'll start there. Mm-hmm. And I quite liked that. And I wasn't blown away, and then I picked up a couple of odd things, one of which was some of the jazzy era, and I thought, oh, they're all right, but I don't get this. You know, I'm not a huge fan. And again, I went to see, I met this guy when I was in the when I was travelling, and he said, I'm coming to the States in the summer. He said, oh, where are you going? I said, oh, I'm flying into LA, I'm coming to San Francisco. I said, what I really want to do is go and see the Grateful Dead. And he said, first, second, or third of July at Shoreline. I'll get your tickets. You can come and stay at the flat. And I think it's a classic Deadhead story. And you know, I spent a week with him and we went to these gigs. And it, again, it was, well, it was a strange mix because there were a lot of younger people there because they'd had a revival of interest. They were very much a student band. And again, this was really just outside. This is Palo Alto, Stanford, so this was effectively a hometown gig for them, plus all the Jerry Garcia lookalikes with the grey beards and the painted yeah. yellow school buses and all points in between. And I just thought it was a fantastic atmosphere. I mean, they, you know, compared to the glory days, they weren't very good, but I had a great yeah. night. But I pillaged this guy's CD because I was just taping it, you know, and then I came back and then you hit live then, you're thinking, ah, right, now I get it, now yes. I get it, yeah. now I see it. And they did play a variety of styles. I mean, on certain nights they weren't very good, you know, and they were never really a very good rock and roll band, but they could, their ability to improvise almost telepathically is phenomenal. And if you listen to the live Dark Star from Dark Star, you see the way they just follow each other. And the way you, if you just try and play like air bass along with what Phil Lesh is playing, and just try and anticipate where he's going, he doesn't know because he's following the other, you know, and you think they're making this up on the fly. They're not even rehearsed, they're just making, and that those are fantastic. But they did a huge variety of styles. And they had, you know, 67 to 77 was the golden age, really.
Yeah.
But the other thing, of course, was, as you talked about, the taping scene. They allowed, they were smart enough to realise that they never played the same gig twice. So they allowed people to record it and freely trade them. And it was viral marketing before anybody came up with that expression.
Yeah, yeah.
But plus they also had, they got high quality soundboard recordings of almost every show. And a lot of them are freely circulated. And they're as good as a live album, really. Mm. And it's free. You know, so the sheer amount of material that you can accumulate is phenomenal. And people have their favourite years. And then people have, you know, oh, February 74 is my favourite. You know, video, you know. And then the Europe 72 box set's coming out in September.
Yeah, I've been reading about that.
It's crept up to 70. It was 72 quite nicely. 72 discs, now 73 discs. I think they played about 28 shows or something, but you know, to the fans, that's the mother load, you know, that's every single note and twang that they could find of the whole lot, all, you know, and it's just simply, I mean, how you could begin to wade through it all.
It's a bit of a daunting prospect, isn't it?
It is, but and some of those second sets, they were quite intense again, I think it's an acquired, and I think you also have to realise what you're listening to. And you listen to, because I realised when I started listening to them that I don't listen to music, I just hear it.
Right.
I just hear the tune and you think, no, if you're thinking this is just a tune that's dirge, you're thinking, no, just listen. Just pick one instrument and follow how it moves and who's playing what. And you're thinking, oh, drums. And in some of these jams, it's just incredible how they can do it. And I think you then listen to it and you listen to them and how they pick up on what the other people play. And that gave me a huge understanding of kind of ensemble playing, you know, which is why they appeal to the sort of jazz community. You know, certainly in probably parts of 74, they were a jazz band to all intents, or jazz rock. That's in too abhorrent a concept, but they had different phases, but the way they're playing against each other and off each other and stuff, and the way the subtle cues and things is very, very good. Yeah.
Well, hopefully that will have inspired a few people to go and check them out or revisit them the same way as I have. Okay, John, is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
No, I thought probably probably.
I mean, we said 10 minutes and been going 50 so far, so sorry.
So, yeah, that'll fill your hour, won't it? No, I won't launch into download downloads versus vinyl.
Well, you can if you like. But
it's all part of what I've been saying earlier. I think the whole, you know, the recorded music and physical product, going out and buying an album, even going out and buying a CD now is people don't want the discs, they just want the songs.
I do, yeah, I still buy them.
Well, I do, but a lot of the younger people don't, you know, and they told them they don't own any physical, you know, where's your record collection?
Yeah.
matchbox with a screen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, but again, we were lucky. You know, I think in the certainly late 80s, early 90s, once CDs were established, that you know, you could buy cheap vinyl, you could buy a whole load of second-hand vinyl.
Yes, so everybody was ditching their collection.
What about this Joni Mitchell? What about this Grateful Dead? What about some? And you could go out and you could buy the albums for £2 or £3, £4.
Yeah,
quid.
That's true.
And you could build up a club, but you could invest. I mean, now you just go on Spotify or YouTube or something, which in some ways is fantastic because, I mean, like bands like The Dead, I'd heard of, and you'd go in there and you're thinking, I'm paying £15 for something.
Spotify is great for that. I use that a lot when I'm working. It's good.
Yeah, you know, but now you can go on Spotify, you can listen to anybody you like. But I do, in a sense, I think it devalues the product.
It does.
But I mean, LPs are, you know, they're completely impractical. You know, and it's not a robust mechanism. But,
no.
But for people who are, you know, but it's an album and it's big and it's got pictures and you get the disc and you put it on and you sit and listen.
It's
to
a
it.
Ritual. That's what it is.
Exactly, the ritual.
Yeah.
And the flicking through and you go into someone's house, let's have a look at your records. You know, and you flick through and you've got that. Oh, stick that on. You know, what this is supposed to be. You know, screaming faces.
I really miss that actually.
And you look. I remember my mate bought In the Court of the Crimson King. And I
yeah, there's a cover.
And I think, you know, if it sounds like the cover, one of you're thinking, but it's one of those iconic. I keep seeing this. What is it? Stick it on.
Yeah.
I want to hear this. You know, and then you skip someone, you go, "Are you all right, mate?" And you turn it off.
But, how can you say that?
but if you get that, if you start at track two, it's a different story. But I couldn't get beyond Schizoid, mate.
Right.
But you're and your friends got into different stuff. And then I remember going to college because all my mates were all into much the same stuff. You go to college and the people into completely different things.
Yeah.
You go, what? I'm bored of them. Stick it on. What's it like? Come on. Yeah. You know. Well, the guy down the end of the corridor was into psychobilly, and I thought, you know, put it on. What's it? Yeah, you were right, you know, but I want to hear it. I don't like it, but I want to hear it, you know. People come to me and go, I've heard it. What's this stuff? What's this, you know?
Well, maybe headphones have got a lot to blame for as well. I hadn't really thought about that before.
I mean, you don't hear stuff creeping. I had the door open in my room at college, and somebody walks in and goes, 60s dope party music, why is this? I've always wanted this. That's the live version of Elizabeth Reed by the Allman Brothers Band. He goes, I copy that for me now. You know, and that those moments where you hear something, you go, oh, I've got to have that, what's that?
Yeah.
Or people can go, what is this?
You That's know? Right.
You know, when you're playing 200 years ago, somebody died. No, I'm just chilling out.
Okay. Well, John, keep me posted about what's happening next year, because we'll make sure. I know you post to the mailing list, but we'll actually talk. I'll talk about it on the podcast, which still does come out vaguely frequently. And I gather we might be seeing you at the Royal Festival Hall in November.
Oh yes, I should be there. Yes,
yeah, that's what we like to hear. So there's exciting times ahead. And
yes,
thank you so much.
I'm just seeking suspicion. I'm just wondering whether it's good, depending on who the special guests are, which I couldn't get out of Nick at all.
Yeah.
The sworn to secrecy. In the back of my mind, I've got a feeling it might almost be Roy's testimonial, but I don't know.
Yeah, it may be. Yeah, it might be. He might have decided it's the time to actually pull in all the favours, as it were. I don't know.
It would be a good way for him to end.
It would.
Don't want it to, but it would.
Yeah.
But I don't, yeah.
Okay. Well, keep doing what you're doing, John, and thanks very much for coming.
Yes, and you likewise.
And, thanks for giving me such a fun time last month. That was excellent.
Well, we try. We do what we can for people.
Quality control has failed to sift us out. Head office has not been informed. As we leap from the gutter to the hole, in the wall. Connection's down and the fuse is blown. Something is wrong with the machine. As we leap from the twister to the low in the sky, in the sky. We're not scared, yeah. We're not scared. We're not scared of Carmageddon. Carmageddon. I don't really care what happens anymore. Isn't it the same thing in the end? As we leap to the chill zone from the lows on the floor. I'm getting out what I'm putting in. It all comes around in the end. Karma, as we leap from the womb to the holes in space, in space. Yeah, we're not scared, we're not scared. Carmageddon, 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 Carmageddon. As we shape to kiss,
that was Nick Harper performing live at the Summer of Love party this year with the track Carmageddon. That was taken straight off the mixing desk, and many thanks, Nick, for giving me permission to play that track. You can find out more about Nick, if you don't know his music already, at www.harperspace.com. Now, another rare track, I think, and we're going to have Waiting for Godot, again from Songs of Love and Loss.
Youth went a-wooing, fleet of the feet, ran the horizons living his life out for love, never knowing how fast they could meet. All too soon it was over, gone in a flash, wilted and withered, limping away out of love, out of time, out of life, at a dash. It won't be long now before all the skies come circling overhead, waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. For God, oh, ravenous cries. For summer is fading, here come the storms. The mirror's got misty, crying my heart out for love as I lie in the last of her arms. It won't be long now before all the skies come circling overhead, waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. Waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. So let us be gentle, especially with us. Share all our moments, treasure the pleasure of love as we fathom uncertain, because it won't be long now before all the skies come circling overhead, waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. Waiting for Godot with ravenous cries. Really
beautiful music. Now, a little bit of listener feedback from the last podcast. And John Barker, IOM, one assumes that's from the Isle of Man, has recently found the podcast, and the poor devil has been listening to loads of the archives, as you can as well if you're a new listener. They're all still online. He says he's really looking forward to hearing his first new podcast, i.e. not been languishing on the hard drive for a long time. I was asked whether there was going to be a part two of a Darren Crisp interview. I interviewed Darren a long time ago. Darren used to be Roy's manager and ran the record company quite a long time ago now. And as you can imagine, has some very interesting things to say. And what I basically said was we've always had the idea of getting Darren back to do a second chat. In fact, we've tried to meet up a couple of times when he's been on tour in this rough area, but we've never managed to actually make it happen yet. But I haven't given up, so we'll see what happens. We had a bit of a discussion about the Wire magazine interview, and Big Chris was kind enough to point out you could order a copy online via the website, which I subsequently did and thoroughly enjoyed reading. Okay, no celebrity. Says, it took me a week to listen to, Paul. I was listening to my new download at once and checking out the Legends DVD all that week. Got Les Cousins and BBC CDs today on Monday. Looney is now all I'm missing besides half my brain. Well, that's that's debatable. Great stuff. I think Roy sounded so young in part because the original tape was sped up slightly and all the mics were further away. Also, loved Roy's early insight into how they needed to get Jimmy onto his feet before he really started rocking. I nearly fell out of my chair when I realised you were quoting my comments on the previous podcast. I forgot I was so lengthy and entertaining in my commentary, tongue-in-cheek. Can't wait for your next podcast. Neither can I. Bob Jacobs says, I've had episode 33 on my iPod since it was published, but forgot to listen to it till yesterday when it accompanied me to and from work. Loved the Legends version of Me and My Woman and Kitchen Cynics stuff. Keep up the good work. When that episode finished, my iPod seamlessly took me into episode 15, I think, which featured the peerless Dave Cochran, raconteur extraordinary. Any chance of getting him back to tell us a few more anecdotes and perhaps play us some of those tapes he's got in his archives? Well, I have spoken to Dave. He's coming over for the November gig. I don't know whether he's playing or not. I hope he will be. And provisionally, we are going to get together and see if we can get something recorded for your entertainment. Kenny Wisdom says, Paul, that would be great, in response to the news about Dave Cochran. It's just amazing at the moment. Whoever's doing his PR needs a slap on the back, in the nicest possible sense of that statement, of course. I don't really use Twitter that much. Well, not properly, but after hearing all the comments that Roy Harper was trending, I went in to look for myself. What a groundswell of support Roy is getting. Oh well, he's been our best kept secret for too long, I suppose. Time to share the Roy. Dr. Doom the Optimist says, indeed, my mum texted me to say Roy Harper is on the telly on Monday morning. That's never happened before, and I doubt it will happen again. Then he's on later, and then on Radio 2, Mike Harding. Quite a few magazine articles and interviews too. This is just bizarre. Great, but bizarre. I loved his later performance. Very delicate. It looked like it could fall apart at any moment, but didn't. Great choice of song as well. Bob Jacobs replied to that saying, my spontaneous comment as he finished another day was, thank you, Roy, spellbinding. She who must be obeyed went, eh? As if I was mad. I think it helped that it was such a familiar, much-loved song with brilliant lyrics and such an intimate performance. Andy Watterson says, wonderful stuff to see so much of Roy recently. He's certainly travelling around a bit these days and his face looked a bit tired under the eyes, but another day has been an old-time favourite for many a decade and or girlfriend, and I get instantly transported back to cosy, loving memories. Although I prefer to keep him as my little national treasure or secret, all this publicity is a bit of an anathem, I don't know how you pronounce that, to me. He's here for all of us, and he's ours. Finally, Royden says, podcast 34 is going to be about 15 hours long if this carries on. Great times. Well, I've tried to keep it relatively short, Royden. You did also suggest that I do a best-of podcast, catching up on the last 34 episodes. I really like the idea, but can you imagine how long it's going to take me to go through 34 podcasts, averaging, I don't know, an hour and 20 minutes each, picking out good bits? Blimey, it's a bit of a task, isn't it? But I do really like the idea, so I'm thinking about it. Okay, that's it for the feedback. Please do write in. I'd love to hear from you, new listeners or old listeners, whatever you have to say. Drop me an email, pd@stormcock.net. If you want, and I'd really like it if you did, record yourself, give me a voice message and send me an MP3. I'll play it on the podcast, and I really like receiving those, although I think most people are a bit shy, which I fully sympathise with, by the way. I hate listening to my voice back on these things. You can also give us a review on iTunes if you like. We are on there. And, you know, the more people that say it's worth listening to, the better. Credits and copyright. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 2.0 UK, England and Wales license, which basically means you can freely share it with other people, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge any money for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. Also, many thanks to Nick Harper for permission to use his track from the Summer of Love party this time. And I think that's more or less it. So, as I said before, I'm hoping that another podcast will arrive within the next 4 or 5 weeks. Let's keep our fingers crossed on that one. And I'll leave you with one more track from Songs of Love and Loss, and this is The Flycatcher. See you next time. Bye for now.
I saw a fine lady ghost across the tops with a ring on her finger and the wind's on her toes. She can have music wherever she goes. Those were the days in the cradle of our love. Those are the days I dream of sweetly. Those were the days. Above the flycatcher, the cherry tree, the chestnut gophers, as the last hope of sunshine embers on the hill at the end of all the rainbow. Where the timeless legends dwell, a ghostly coach and four storms the midnight rain. Silently aurora, almightily refrains. Those were the days. The cherry tree, the chestnut grove.